Chapter 56. Mama Kay stepped into the physicker's shop as Kylar swept the sword up into his hand. She was too late to stop him. Vi didn't move. She knelt motionless, her shiny red hair pulled out of the sword's path to her neck. The sword descended and bounced off. The shock of the collision rang the sword like a bell. The sword whisked out of Kylar's nerveless grip.
"You will not do murder in my shop!"
Drissa Nile said. Her voice carried such power, and her eyes such fire, that her diminutive frame might as well have been a giant's. Even though Kylar had to look down to meet her eyes, he was intimidated.
"We've accomplished an excellent piece of healing with this woman, and I'll not have you spoil it,"
Drissa said.
"You healed her?"
Kylar asked. Vi still hadn't moved. She faced the floor.
"From compulsion," Mama Kay said. "Am I right?"
"How did you know that?"
Trevor asked.
"If it happens in my city, I know," Mama Kay said. She turned to Kylar. "The God King bound her with a magic that forced her to obey direct orders."
"How convenient," Kylar said.
His face contorted as he crushed the tears that were rising.
"I don't care. She killed Jarl. I mopped up his blood. I buried him."
Mama Kay touched Kylar's arm.
"Kylar, Vi and Jarl practically grew up together. Jarl protected her. They were friends, Kylar. The kind of friends that never forget. I don't believe anything less than magic could have compelled her to hurt him. Isn't that right, Vi?"
Mama Kay put her hands under Vi's chin and brought her face up. Tears streamed down Vi's face in mute testimony.
"What did Durzo teach you, Kylar?"
Mama Kay asked.
"A wet boy is a knife. Is the guilt the knife's or the hands?"
"Both. And damn Durzo for his lies."
There was a knife on Kylar's belt, but he'd already tested its edge. Sister Drissa had blunted it, as he had guessed she might. But she didn't know about the blades up his sleeves, nor could she stop the weapons that were his hands. Vi saw the look in his eyes. She was a wet boy, she knew. He could get a knife out and across her throat in the time it took Drissa to blink. Let the healer try to cure death. Vi's eyes were black with guilt, a mishmash of dark images he couldn't comprehend. A short rush of black figures passed through his mind's eye. Her victims?
"She's murdered fewer people than you have."
The thought hit him like a shot in the solar plexus. Some guilt, some judge. And the look on her face was all readiness above the tears. There was no self-pity, no avoidance of responsibility. Her eyes spoke for her.
"I killed Jarl. I deserve to die. If you kill me, I won't blame you."
"Before you decide, you have to know there's more," Vi said. "You were a secondary target. After Jarl, I couldn't do it."
"Well, that's commendable," Mama Kay said.
"So I kidnapped Uli to make sure you'd follow me."
"You what?"
Kylar said.
"I figured you'd follow me back to Cenaria. The God King wants you alive, but Sister Ariel captured me and Uli. When we found you, I thought you were dead. I thought I was free, so I escaped Sister Ariel and came here."
"Where's Uli?"
"On her way to the Chantry. Uli's talented. She's going to be a major."
It was horrifying and yet perfect. Uli would be a sister. She'd be taken care of, educated. Kylar had imposed Uli on Eileen. Eileen hadn't chosen to have a daughter who was more the age of a little sister. It wasn't a burden that had been fair for Kylar to ask her to assume. This way, and with the fortune that Kylar had left for her, Eileen would be free to have her own life again. It was all logical. He had a niggling doubt that he wasn't thinking the way Eileen would think. He could do nothing about that. Finding out that the damage had been minimized eased his mind. A sudden fire lit in Mama Kay's eyes at the thought of her daughter being taken to the chantry, but Kailar couldn't tell whether she was upset that her daughter had been taken, or pleased that her daughter would certainly become a woman of consequence. Either way, Mama Kay quickly smothered it. She wasn't about to let strangers know Uli was her daughter. If he got through this, Kailar would go to the chantry and see Uli. He wasn't angry that they'd taken her from Vi. If anything, he owed them. And for a girl who was talented, going to the chantry wasn't really optional. It was supposed to be dangerous for a child to learn on her own. But if Uli didn't want to stay, and they tried to keep her, Kailar would tear down the white seraph around the sister's ears. But just thinking about Uli made him think about Eileen, and thinking about Eileen threw his emotions into turmoil. So Kailar asked, "Why are you so eager to save Vi?" Mama Kay never worked on just one level. "Because," Mama Kay said, "if you're going to kill the God King, you'll need Vi's help." "Say one thing for Kurok. The mages are wrong. It wasn't in the form of a sword for purely symbolic reasons. The son of a bitch could cut." It was a good thing, too. The Saussurei were implacable. They were called Saussurei, Old Jaren for sword lords, for good reason. Nonetheless, Fi'ir was a blade master of the second echelon. The first clash left three of the Siurin warriors dead and gave Fi'ir a short, tough pony. Soon, Fi'ir's height and weight proved a liability again. The pony tired and slowed. In the darkness, Fi'ir let it go. Unfortunately, the little warhorse was trained too well. It stopped and waited for its rider the moment it was released. Fi'ir solved that problem, tying a small weave of magic under its saddle that randomly prickled. It would keep the beast running for hours. If he were lucky, the Saussurei would lose his trail and follow the horse. He was lucky. It bought him a number of hours. Hours on foot. It brought him to the crest of the mountain. He had cut a sapling before he'd hiked over the tree line, and now he was working on the wood with Kurok. The sword had an edge like he couldn't believe, but it wasn't a plane or a chisel. Right now, he needed both, and a few other tools besides. Dorian once told him about a sport the more suicidal Highland tribes practiced. They called it schluss. It consisted of strapping small sleds to one's feet and going downhill at incredible speeds. Standing, Dorian contended that they could steer, but Fi'ir hadn't figured out how. All he knew was that he had to go faster than the Siurins pursuing him, and there was no way he could build a full sled in the time he had. What he couldn't accomplish with the blade, he accomplished with magic. He was a maker, after all. Wood chips flew as the sun rose. But he had skylined himself like a fool. Standing right at the edge of the mountain so that his figure was clearly visible for miles, the Saussurei saw him before he saw them. They had dismounted and were walking on top of the snow with broad, woven bamboo shoes strapped to their feet. The gait they had to assume to keep from tripping over the snowshoes was comical, until Fi'ir realized how fast it let them travel. They would cover in a few minutes what had taken Fi'ir half an hour lumbering through the snow. He worked faster. He almost forgot to turn up the front tip of each long, narrow sled. He shook his head. He'd caught that mistake. What else had he missed? He didn't have time to fashion proper fasteners, so he wove a web of magic around his shoes and feet and bound them directly to the wood planks. He stood and immediately caught an edge and fell. "Damn! Why'd I square the edges?" He should have left them curving like a boat's hull. Standing was embarrassingly difficult. Fi'ir cursed as the Siorans came closer. He was a second echelon blade master, and he was this clumsy? This was madness. He should have just run downhill. He rolled over onto his butt, and finally used the length of the planks to lever himself into a squat. He stood and tried to step forward. The schluces, which he had smoothed and polished, did exactly what they were supposed to do. They slid back and forth, and Fi'ir barely moved. Fi'ir looked over his shoulder. The Sa-Siorai were a bare 100 paces back now. If it came to a fight, the schluces would doom him. He stumbled, caught an edge, and threw his foot to the side to catch himself. He staggered and slid forward. The joy was as great as he'd felt when he'd been named a maker in the Brotherhood. He turned each schluce outward and pushed forward. It worked until he got to the edge and started moving downhill faster than he could step. Each schluce went the way he had pointed it. Out. His legs stretched until they could stretch no more, and he pitched forward on his face. The mountain was steep, and the snow mercifully deep. Air was scarce as Fi'ir flipped over and over through the powder. He was dimly aware that he needed to point the schluces downhill. After 6 or 7 rolls, it happened. Suddenly, Fi'ir burst out of the omnipresent snow. The snow was at least 3 feet deep. But he was on top of it. His heart was a thunder in his chest. He was headed straight downhill at incredible speed. In moments, he was going faster than the fastest horse, and then faster, and faster still. Controlling the two schluces independently was almost impossible, so he quickly lashed them together with magic, both front and back, giving each a little leeway. There were more crashes, and sometimes the snow wasn't as forgiving. Finally, Fi'ir learned how to steer. He steered around a rocky death and looked downhill for the first time, squinting against the white. He blinked.
What is that line in the snow?
He shot over the precipice. For 2 seconds, there was no schluce of sleds on snow. The world was silent, except for the blast of wind in his ears. Then he landed. He crashed through a world of white powder, flipping, arms and legs pulled every which way. Then the miracle happened again, and he popped out of the snow to fly downhill once more. His heart hammered. He laughed. He had Kurok. He was safe. The Siorans wouldn't follow him down the mountain. Doing so would put them in Cenaria. He'd escaped!
Incredible! Lantano Garawashi said. He was a big man for a Siurin. His red hair hung thick and long with dozens of narrow sections of differently colored hair bound in. In Siura, it was said that you could read a man's life in his hair. At a boy's clan initiation, his head was shaved bald except for one forelock. When the forelock had grown the length of 3 fingers, it was bound with a tiny ring, and the boy declared a man. When he killed his first warrior, the forelock was bound again at the scalp, and he became Sa-Siorai. The shorter the span between the 2 rings on the forelocks, the better. Thereafter, when the Sa-Siorai killed an enemy, he bound the slain man's forelock to his own hair. At first, a few warriors had thought Lantano only had 1 ring, because his first 2 were right on top of each other. He killed his first opponent at 13. In the 17 years since, he'd added 59 locks to his own hair. Had he been born a little higher, all of Siora would have followed him. But a Sa-Siorai's soul was his sword, and nothing could change that Lantano had been born with an iron sword, a peasant sword.
Lantano was a warlord because Sioran tradition allowed any man of excellence to lead armies. But for Lantano, it had become a trap. As soon as he stopped fighting, his power ended. He'd begun fighting for Siora's regent, Hideo Watanabe. Then, when the regent ordered him to disband, he became a mercenary instead. Desperate men flocked to his banners for one reason. He never lost. The giant was becoming a speck in the distance.
Warmaster, do you wish us follow?
A stump of a man with a score of locks tied in his balding hair asked.
We'll try the caves, Lantano said.
Into Cenaria?
Just 100 sassurai.
It'll be a cold winter.
Killing this giant will give us a tail to keep us warm.